The Bush administration, rather than working to preserve American freedom and democracy, is working relentlessly to limit civil liberties and stifle dissent in pursuit of political, economic, and cultural hegemony.
The United States is still very angry at Iran for the hostage crisis that took place so many years ago. And it's curious because 75% of the Iranian population is under the age of 25, and they don't remember this at all.
The detainee, a right to a fair trial, is a nonsense. No lawyer could possibly defend a person when all the damage has been done over a year and a half.
My son and I are holding up a banner. The banner says, U.S. hands off Iran.
United Nations, pay us attention!
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, July 9th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. forces captured Iraq's swashbuckling former interior minister while a top-level Ba'ath Party official surrendered. The latest arrest from a list of 55 most wanted fugitives from Saddam Hussein's ousted regime. 34 of those on the list have now been detained, but despite a huge bounty and a feverish search, the hunt is still missing its biggest quarry, Saddam and his two sons. The Senate Armed Services Committee held hearings today on the U.S.'s engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan. Maine Senator Susan Collins recently returned from Iraq with members of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Collins was one of eight senators who traveled through Qatar and Kuwait before entering Iraq. They went to Iraq to learn more about the status of the reconstruction plans following the war, to meet with American troops, and to talk with military and diplomatic leaders. Collins shared her conversations with the troops in Iraq with the committee and Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld.
To a person, I found that our troops' morale was very high, despite the harsh conditions under which they're serving and despite the dangers to which they are exposed. But I also found a weariness among our troops. And over, I heard, I'm proud of our mission. I helped free the Iraqi people, but when do I get to go home? So I think it is important that we communicate to the men and women who are serving so that they will have some expectations. One soldier from Maine told me, I can deal with another 3 months, I can deal with another 6 months, but I just need to know. So I would encourage you, and I know that General Abbasad is working on this, but to share that information with our men and women in uniform as quickly as it is available so there can be some certainty. I would also ask you, Mr. Secretary, to project for us what you see as the percentage mix of American troops versus troops from other countries as part of the coalition forces by the end of the year. Obviously, we can rotate troops home more quickly if we can replace them not just with American troops, but with troops from other countries. Could you give us a rough estimate of what you see as the percentages of American troops versus troops from other countries as part of the coalition forces by the end of the year?
Well, as General Franks and I have indicated, we now have about 148,000 troops there. We're hoping to get the non-U.S. coalition forces up to something like, at the moment, we're looking at 30,000 sometime late summer, early fall. We intend to have the Iraqi army grow as rapidly as we can do so. And there's actually a fourth source of forces, and that's contract forces for site protection to the extent that that might make sense. And that's roughly what it looks like to me going out or towards the end of the year.
U.S. Senator from Maine Susan Collins at a hearing of the Armed Services Committee today. President Bush suggested today that any U.S. military help in ending brutal civil unrest in Liberia might consist mostly of advisors and trainers to avoid stretching American forces too thin around the globe. He said, "We won't overextend our troops, period." He said this at a joint news conference with South African President Thabo Mbeki, who had pressed him on what role the U.S. would play in the crisis. U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said today that the U.S. is sending additional military assessment teams to Africa to help decide whether U.S. peacekeeping troops will be dispatched to Liberia. That's according to Reuters. And Bush has ordered that small teams be sent to some member countries of the Economic Community of West African State to determine the readiness of their soldiers to bat peace efforts in Liberia. In addition, Switzerland has imposed additional economic sanctions against Liberia, banning the import of timber and wood products. Peace Watch spoke with BBC correspondent Jonathan Pei Lalay in Monrovia, Liberia, earlier today to get an assessment of what the atmosphere in Liberia is like.
As far as our understanding from the rebel position is concerned, it's all for power. President Taylor is saying that people who are making war against him are the 20% of the population that he defeated in 1997 when the country went to the poll in a post-war election and Taylor won by landslide. So the rebels, on the other hand, are saying that they are fighting to overthrow Taylor because he has not delivered and that his regime has made Liberia to be a rogue state.
What is the political and social climate like in Monrovia these days?
Monrovia has remained calm since the ceasefire came into effect last week. But there is this atmosphere of anxiety with people not being sure of what will happen next in the absence of the immediate coming of peacekeeping troops. But with reports coming out this afternoon that ECOWAS has decided to send a fresh batch of 1,000 soldiers to keep the peace, the reaction in Monrovia has been one of joy, with people at least jumping to the conclusion that there is indeed a light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. There's much that we hear in the news today about the possibility of sending troops into Liberia to actually remove President Taylor from power. He's been accused of war crimes and very recently offered asylum in Nigeria. What, in your opinion, would the ramifications be for the region if Taylor actually leaves power?
The troops that are heading for Liberia, according to ECOWAS, that is West Africa grouping, is to keep the peace because government forces and the rebels have agreed on a truce that has been in effect for about 3 weeks now. So the initial contingent of 1,000 peacekeeping forces is coming to Liberia to keep the peace. President Taylor is under immense pressure to leave Liberia, but there has been no indication of the sending of any outside force to get him out. This might be mere speculation. President Taylor is insisting that before leaving Liberia, as being demanded by the United States and other people in the international community, peacekeeping troops should be on the ground so that there is what he calls a smooth transition. But the U.S. is saying that it will send troops to Liberia only after Taylor shall have left the country. Until we can see the presence of peacekeeping troops on the ground, it will be very difficult to know what will happen to Liberia if President Taylor decides to leave today under pressure and there are no authorities here to take over from him.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, CNN showed UN peacekeeping and humanitarian forces being turned away from a refugee camp. Taylor later reported that no permission was ever requested of his government for the team to be there in the first place. Bush was reported as saying this was just a diplomatic boo-boo. Do you think this was just an oversight?
The coming of the team was well publicized here in official circles. President Taylor himself made mention of the coming of the team to journalists. But what happened yesterday, as far as my investigation is concerned, is that there was some miscommunication between the government and the authorities of the American team. that had come to assess the humanitarian situation here. The team was hailing for this camp for displaced people. And apparently, because defense officials were not informed about their being there, when there was a telephone contact with the defense minister, he asked that they should come back to him, to the ministry, to talk before proceeding. And that is what the team did exactly. And there was a meeting with the defense minister, and that was followed by the continuation of the team's visit to different camps around Monrovia. So I think to say that they were turned back is a little an overstatement of what actually happened in Monrovia yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you accept the President Bush's explanation, however, that this was just an oversight? Is this an unusual incident, in your opinion? It seems a little odd that a president would, forget to request permission to visit a site in a sovereign nation.
The Americans seem to be operating in a way that they don't want to recognize the existence of a government, or following a call by President Bush for President Tito to step down. So it is apparent that the coming of the team and their decision to go into those places without first talking to the officials on the ground could be because Washington does not regard the existence of an administration here after the call by President Bush. It could also be that the team was expected to talk to officials on the ground before setting out to visit those places, but that the leader of the team forgot to do just that.
Jonathan Pei Lalay is a correspondent for the BBC stationed in Monrovia, Liberia. About 680 foreign citizens are being held without charge at the U.S. military's Guantanamo Bay base in Cuba under suspicion of being members of Al-Qaeda or engaging in international terrorism. According to the New York Times, an undisclosed number of others are being held at undisclosed locations throughout the world. Six people have been selected to be the first prisoners likely to face secret military tribunals. But the families of the British prisoners on the list, two out of a total of nine British citizens being held at Guantanamo Bay, confirmed that they had been contacted by the authorities. The two British citizens identified are Faraz Abbasi and Mozam Beg. Sonali Kalhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke earlier this week with Gareth Pierce, a human rights attorney in England who represented two prisoners in Guantanamo last year and is very familiar with the case of Mozam Beg.
On Thursday night, a message was left about midnight on his telephone at home saying that his son had been demarked for selection and was now likely to face a military tribunal. And of course there have been reports here during the past few weeks, and indeed pictures showing the construction of not only a court in Guantanamo Bay but also an execution chamber. The news from Mozam Beg's family is quite appalling, because over a year and a half the very rare communications they've had by letter from him via the Red Cross have talked about his hope and expectation that this ordeal would soon be over, that he was truly innocent and that he was praying to be reunited with his wife and children someday soon. This now is extraordinary, extraordinary news, as well as terrifying. Now, the chilling features of his position, I think, are more exacerbated than perhaps any other detainee, and probably any of the six now facing a military tribunal. Whatever the conditions in Guantanamo Bay, and they clearly violate almost every international convention on the rights of detainees, whether in wartime or peacetime, Bagram Air Base is clearly in another league, and the constant reports that have emanated from there of the use of torture mean that every detainee confined there was either tortured or in fear of torture, because its use was clearly prevalent. Mozam Beg wrote to his family at the end of last year saying he had not seen the sun, moon, or stars for nearly a year. Now, in terms of considering the process that is now being embarked upon, one has to consider that whatever has been dragged from Moisenberg over a year and a half in terms of potential evidence on which he's now being put on trial, that product is condemned by every national and international norm, minimum norm, of inalienable rights. You cannot obtain evidence to use against an individual which is the product of coercion or coercion and temptation, the temptation to avoid brutality. There is no guarantee that Moisenberg has received even the most basics of humanitarian treatment, but certainly he's enjoyed none of the safeguards that every detainee who's facing trial should face in terms of interrogation and their right against self-incrimination.
Now, the what's facing these six that your client is one of is the choice to either plead guilty and accept a 20-year prison sentence through this U.S. military tribunal, or be executed if found guilty. And the evidence that would implicate them in guilt, you are saying itself, is has been wrought under very, very serious and suspect circumstances. So basically, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Can you talk a little bit about this very bizarre choice that's being given these people?
If that's the choice, then it's no choice at all. A choice that isn't free, freely made, is not a choice. Who's been subject to the pressures that all detainees have been subject to is not safe evidence. But the detainee has been denied every single right that is meant to attract to him, including the right to legal representation. So to superimpose legal representation at the end of all this and suggest that that is giving the detainee a right to a fair trial is a nonsense. No lawyer could possibly defend a person when all the damage has been done over a year and a half.
How has the British government reacted to the cases of these two individuals? Have they in any way risen to defend British citizens?
They've been completely pathetic throughout. The British government, the attempts to get the Foreign Office to intervene on Moisenberg's behalf for the past year and a half have been utterly fruitless.
Prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are not being allowed legal counsel. You are acting as the lawyer for Moisenberg. What power do you have to defend him, if any?
Well, I was going to comment on your use of that term, if only I were a lawyer acting on his behalf. But I am in entirely the wrong jurisdiction to have any effect. The American courts so far, and American lawyers were instructed on Moisenberg's behalf and on behalf of a number of British citizens, and they have been very good people doing a very good job, sustained and intelligent and legally imaginative. They brought habeas corpus proceedings, which last summer were turned down by the American courts on the basis that Guantanamo Bay is not subject to the jurisdiction of American courts. And they said that insofar as individuals there had a remedy, their remedy must lie in diplomatic initiatives by their own governments. Every jurisdiction has avoided responsibility. Every jurisdiction has shrugged it off. And these detainees have fallen into a legal black hole, in which they're drowning and might die. And it is a sorry comment upon the world community that after the end of World War II, when we entered into international treaty obligations under the United Nations and within Europe, the European Convention, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, we entered into binding obligations to say that we would never again allow what happened to happen again, and that nations would police each other. There is an absolute tearing up of history and an ignoring of fundamental inalienable rights that we have guaranteed internationally. We are not policing each other. We are not policing ourselves. And it is a terrifying freefall, both morally and legally, that our respective countries have spun into. How could the world be silent? How could America, of all countries, with its respect for the law, be doing this? That feeling has now been ongoing, and frustration at every attempt to change that situation. That's now replaced with something much more fearful and with a much sharper feeling of emergency attached to it. This is now an emergency. It was always possible for those wrongful detentions emanating from wrongful convictions to be sustained as long as there wasn't public pressure, as long as there wasn't public embarrassment. Each country can generate its own internal pressures, and it's only when those become so great that it is more embarrassing to the government in question to keep detainees in than to let them out, that there will be a change. This now is, we see, this is the exercise of absolute power. And it's a dictatorship, the powers of a dictatorship. No dictator will be ashamed of these powers being used in your country and in ours. And that takes a very substantial groundswell of pressure to do anything about it whatsoever.
Gareth Pierce is a British human rights attorney. She spoke with Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Thanks also to Harmony Rising for production assistance with that piece. With the recent Supreme Court ruling against anti-sodomy laws on the grounds of personal privacy, gay and lesbian Americans have suddenly found themselves in the spotlight as the nation becomes more accepting of their lifestyle. With the recent conclusion of Gay Pride Month, we present now this commentary from Kyle Kitson, offering a gay and lesbian perspective on war.
These days it seems almost taboo to be gay and politically progressive, specifically among my 20-something generation. When the Bush administration first ordered U.S. troops into Afghanistan, I got into an argument with a gay man around my age who told me that in essence I should support the war because we were fighting for freedom and democracy, and consequently for gay rights in the United States. I responded that I didn't think gay rights, or human rights for that matter, were typically won by carpet bombing, quote-unquote, third world nations. Rather, our rights were won by concerned people taking to the streets, acknowledging the universality of oppression, and petitioning the government and hateful violence, human rights abuses, and all forms of institutional discrimination. I told him that war historically and unjustly targeted the most politically and economically disadvantaged segments of society, including Iraqi children, Afghani refugees, and a large proportion of the U.S. military itself, not to mention closeted LGBT service members. As I spoke to him, unable to hold back my anger, I started thinking about the role of identity politics and the overarching role of progressive politics in the LGBT community. Well, I realize some see sexuality as a limited matter of whom one chooses to identify with, to sleep with, and to love. I would argue that those who consider themselves a part of the LGBT community are making an innately political statement whether we like it or not. Despite some encouraging evidence to the contrary, our alternative sexual identities remain largely at odds with dominant norms in the United States and throughout the world. Of course, we might not realize that our sexuality is a political issue until the police actually enter our bedrooms and arrest us for sodomy. Unfortunately, it is political when we're fired for being gay. It is political when we're physically targeted by gay bashers because of our real or perceived sexual orientation. It is political when the state prevents us from marrying our partners, adopting their children, or staying beside them on their deathbeds. When politics enters our personal lives in this manner, we are compelled to take action. But must we wait for politics to affect us before we affect political change? And must we only focus our political action on the issues that directly affect us? Now more than ever, I remember the words of Sabatista leader Subcomandante Marcos, who responded to the Mexican government's claim that he was a homosexual by writing the following poem. Yes, Marcos is gay. Marcos is gay in San Francisco, black in South Africa, an Asian in Europe, a Chicano in San Ysidro, an anarchist in Spain, a Palestinian in Israel, a Mayan Indian on the streets of San Cristobal, a Jew in Germany, a gypsy in Poland, a Mohawk in Quebec, a pacifist in Bosnia, a single woman on the metro at 10 p.m., a peasant without land, a gang member in the slums, an unemployed worker, an unhappy student, and of course, a Zapatista in the mountains. Marcos is all the exploited, marginalized, oppressed minorities resisting and saying enough. He is every minority who is now beginning to speak, and every majority that must shut up and listen. He is every untolerated group searching for a way to speak. Everything that makes power and the good consciences of those in power uncomfortable, this is Marcos. Like Marcos, I believe that minority groups have the charge not only to analyze and confront our own oppression, but also to recognize the systemic patterns of dominance and bigotry that oppress us all. LGBT people must recognize their status as a political entity and connect it to the current political climate. I, for one, refuse to allow the government to further endanger my queer body through global imperialism. The Bush administration, rather than working to preserve American freedom and democracy, is working relentlessly to limit civil liberties and stifle dissent in pursuit of political, economic, and cultural hegemony. If the United States truly wishes to bring democracy to the Middle East, it must model genuine democracy rather than manipulating it through propaganda and intimidation. This ongoing march to war represents the deterioration of every democratic ideal I hold as an American citizen, and I think that calls for massive resistance and action on the part of all disempowered groups. We may be dissonant parts in the whole of oppression, but by raising our voices together, we can transform our dissonance into a harmonious and formidable opposition to that which confines us all. I am Marcos, and so are you.
Kyle Kitson is a volunteer with the IMR, the IMRU, the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgendered radio program on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Special thanks to Kathy Sanchez for production assistance with that piece. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.